You're listening to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette, episode 28. Welcome to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette. That's me, the podcast that's filled with refreshingly honest conversations about the wonderful mess of being human. As your host, it's my delightful honor to sit down with a wide range of people. I talk to everyone from athletes, writers, and entrepreneurs to parents, artists, world travelers, life coaches, and tons of others. Together, we open up about the truth of what's really going on in our lives. We go deep on a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff that's not talked about elsewhere, like daily routines, guilty pleasures. We talk about hard stuff, regrets, fears, current struggles, money stuff, relationships, goal-setting systems, self-care practices, and more. Each conversation brings up different topics, which means different raw truths that we share and different stories. And my hope is that listening to this show makes you laugh, think, and just feel less alone. Because honestly, that's all that I ever want and need, to know that I'm not alone in the fears that I feel every day, the hard stuff, the, you know, just all of that messy humanness. It's really comforting to know that I'm not alone. Making this show for you is the creative love of my life, and it's also such a fun way for me to share a few of my favorite things with you, tools and products that are a part of my real everyday life. And to do this, I partner up with one company per season, a company whose product or program I truly use and love, and I'm stoked to recommend. And I have the privilege of giving you a special discount that allows you to test them out and fall in love with them too. So this season, I am so excited to have partnered with Picky Bars, a ridiculously delicious real food energy bar that I eat pretty much daily, sometimes twice a day, to be honest. What? They're that good. If you know me, you know that I love to cook, bake, and experiment in the kitchen, which means that, if I'm being honest, I hardly buy any packaged foods. Picky Bar is my big exception because they use ingredients like organic dates, almond butter, and blueberries, just as an example. You know, real food that you can actually recognize when reading the label, which is more rare than it should be, but that is a rant for another day. These bars also have a really fun origin story. So obviously I've told you they're delicious. Sometimes that's really all you need to know, but I'm personally really curious about how different products came to be, how companies got started. And so if you hang with me for a second, I want to tell you the Picky Bars story. So back in 2010, pro triathlete Jesse Thomas, who actually lives and trains here in Bend, where I live, he's a great guy, he needed a bar that satisfied his nutritional and training needs. He needed something he could eat before, during, and after his workouts that was easily digestible and filled with real food. But the only bars on the market were either performance bars, which were full of gnarly ingredients that no one really wants to eat, or more real food bars that weren't nutritionally balanced for his athletic needs. They didn't have the right ratio of carbs to protein, that kind of thing. There really just wasn't anything that met all of his needs, ticked all the boxes. Luckily, this is when Jesse's wife, pro runner Lauren Fleshman, who is a guest on the show this season, woo woo, very exciting. She and their friend and fellow pro runner Stephanie Bruce stepped in, and together they set out to create something completely unique, a delicious bar that would be easy for Jesse to eat and digest on long bike rides, something that would be safe on all of their stomachs before hard workouts, because no one wants mid-workout cramps. I have had them, and they are the worst. And more than anything, they wanted to create a bar that would be free of ingredients that are hard on the body. That means no gluten, no dairy, no soy, no GMOs, none of that crap. So out of their home kitchen, the first batch of Picky Bars was born. And at first, they simply passed out the bars to their friends, fellow athletes, family, sliced up and stored in little Ziploc baggies. Not fancy, not fussy. It was never meant to be a business. They never planned to create a business, which I think is so funny given how popular Picky Bars are now. But people liked the bars. They loved them, in fact, and demand grew. After Steph impulsively told Runner's World about Picky Bars, they threw together a website, and the rest is history, with Picky Bars now feeding the dreams of athletes, active people, and picky eaters everywhere. And that includes picky children as well. My husband Paul and I are even members of their Picky Club, which is a monthly subscription service where we get to choose how many bars we want, which flavors we want, and we receive a box in the mail every month, and it is like magic. And I say that because we have a drawer in our kitchen. We call it the Picky Drawer. Yes, this is how many Picky Bars we eat. We have a drawer totally dedicated to Picky Bars. And when that is running low, or heaven forbid, when it gets empty, it does feel like magic when the new bars arrive. So there are currently 7 flavors to choose from. There's really something for everyone. If you love chocolate, there's something for you. If you hate chocolate, there's something for you. If you want lots of nuts, if you're allergic to nuts and would prefer to have seeds, you know, there's really something for everyone, you know, within just these 7 flavors. And the best way to taste them all is the 14 bar mixed pack. This is how I started, was with a mixed pack. I was just curious to taste out a bunch of different flavors. So that's what I have a discount code for you for today. So you can get $10 off that 14 bar mix pack if you go to pickybars.com and use the code REALFOOD. You'll save 10 bucks. You'll get to try the 7 flavors, 2 of each bar. It's a great deal. And if you're looking for a new fun snack, something that's just easy to throw in your bag, keep in the car, take while traveling, eat after a run, that kind of thing, they're perfect. And I honestly have no doubt that you'll love them, which is why I'm so excited and confident to recommend them. So one more time, the discount code for the 14 bar mixed pack is REALFOOD, and you'll find everything you need at pickybars.com. Excellent. So let's get to today's show. In each episode, I bring you an in-depth conversation with a new guest. And in today's episode, you'll get to meet Teresa Reed, aka the Tarot Lady. She's an intuitive tarot reader, teacher, mentor, and yogi on a mission to take tarot from hippie to hip. When she's not reading tarot, she's busy helping fellow mystics learn how to create sustainable and profitable businesses. Her first book, The Tarot Coloring Book, is due to drop November 2016. In this episode, we geek out over our mutual love of food and cooking, which was a surprise. I did not know we were going to wind up talking about that. We talk about setting boundaries in your life and work, the desire to belong, how to develop your own intuition, as well as a story of how Teresa first found tarot and the 30-plus year of evolution of her practice and her business. She also gives us some excellent real talk about why we need to treat our passion-based businesses in a professional way. This conversation, you know, with that topic and so many others, it's just filled with lots of wisdom. I'm deeply grateful that I got to spend this time with Teresa, especially since it was actually a tarot reading that she did for me that led me to pull the trigger on starting this very podcast. So we talk about that as well. All of that starts in just a moment. And as always, you'll be able to find all of the links and resources mentioned in this episode over in the show notes at nicoleantoinette.com/podcast. Excellent. We're good to go. Teresa, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here, Nicole.
I am excited to get to know you. And here's where I want to start with my kind of favorite icebreakery get to know you question. I would like you to tell me something that you are totally obsessed with right now.
Ooh, I'm a woman of a lot of obsessions, so you may have just opened up like a total can of worms. The one thing that I'm super, super obsessed with lately has been, of course, cooking. I have been taking some cooking classes and really getting, I've always been into cooking, but ever since I started taking these little classes at this Sur La Table, which is a local store here, it's been really kind of amping up my obsession to a new level. I am an avid cook. I have probably, over 200 cookbooks. So I am always, always searching for ways to eat well. And that's been my big thing lately. It's just cook, 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 eat, 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 cook, cook, cook.
That's fantastic and something I can completely relate to. It's so funny that you mentioned taking classes at Sur La Table. I used to teach cooking classes at Williams-Sonoma, actually. And I'm very familiar with the kind of cooking store, cooking class setup. But it's really a lot of fun and something that people don't always know about that they usually have like right in their area.
Oh, yeah. And I'm one of those people. I love to learn new things. I love taking classes and, you know, really feeding my brain a lot, as well as, of course, my stomach. And the cooking classes, you know, I've never taken any. And I've just always been really into cooking. And I try to cook at least 3 new things a week. And finally, I decided I need to learn a couple formal things. So I've been taking classes on, I'm taking a pasta class this month and a knife skills class. But I've taken classes in making barks and brittles for holidays and other fun stuff like that. And it's just something so different outside of the work that I do. And it's also my way to be creative and relax, is to get behind the stove and cook. So these classes have been just great fun for me.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It's one of the things that I love the most about
cooking. This might sound strange, but as opposed to a lot of other things that I do in my life or my work that maybe have a really long timeline, or, you know, it takes a long time to see something come to completion, you know, with cooking, it's shorter, it's more instant gratification, you know, 30 minutes later, and I can actually eat this thing. And even if it doesn't turn out great, it's still, oh, I did something. And I don't know, that's part of it for me, that it feels, it's like a little way to relax, and also a kind of reward that comes quicker than maybe other things.
It's a delicious reward too, usually.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So what's, you said you'd make about 3 new things a week, which, I mean, I totally admire that. I think that's fantastic. Have there been any standouts in the last, I don't know, 2 months of things that you were, ooh, that was fantastic?
I would probably say the thing that I made recently that really turned out well is I used a totally new recipe for tiramisu that I normally have been going with this recipe for the joy of cooking, and I've kind of tweaked it for years and years and years. And I found a new recipe for it on Martha Stewart's website, because I also look at websites too for ideas. And I thought, you know, I like Martha. Let me give this a shot. Well, there was not a full plate left in this household. Everybody slammed it. It was so amazing. I love making creamy desserts. That's one of my favorite things. And tiramisu, I've always been pretty good at. But this was a nice new recipe that I really enjoyed.
That's fun. My thing right now, my husband and I are working on making donuts at home. We bought a donut pan, and we're both vegan. So we're working on kind of baked vegan donuts, which has been a fun, interesting, and delicious challenge. So there's a lot of donuts in my house
right
now. Are you familiar with the website Minimalist Baker?
No, I'm not.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So it's my 100% favorite food blog, like favorite. She's also a guest on this season of the show. She and I haven't talked yet, but I'm very, very excited about that. You might enjoy that. Her recipes are all, you know, pretty easy to do, simple, as the name suggests. And she's got a lot of good stuff.
It's right up my alley. I enjoy baking, and I find baking to be also really relaxing. You know, my mother was a very prolific baker, and she made homemade bread and donuts and coffee cakes and homemade bread every week. Every single week, we always had 10 loaves of bread and biscuits and torts and, you know, just all kinds of wonderful baked goods. And so that is in my blood. I'm not as good as she was, but I certainly do aspire.
Did you learn from her? Have you been cooking and baking since you were a child?
Yes, absolutely. I was over her shoulder, and I was in that kitchen all the time. And I used to also read her cookbooks. Reading cookbooks is one of my things. In fact, there's a new cookbook that I'm obsessed with. Speaking of obsessions, it's Chrissy Teigen's new cookbook. And I'm such a fan of hers. I think she is so sassy and so smart. And but I was reading her cookbook and just loving it. And it just brings me back to that time when I was a little girl sitting in mom's kitchen going through all those cookbooks.
Yeah, so, I love reading cookbooks and food magazines too. I remember, so I was a food studies major in college, and I took a course that was on kind of current cultural things with food. That's kind of vague, but one of the things that we talked about was the, you know, kind of growing obsession with cooking shows and just like consuming things related to food that aren't actually consuming food, whether that's reading food magazines or that kind of stuff. And the professor that I had, she called it gastro porn. So you know, or like food porn or something like that, which I think is more kind of, food porn is like a more common term now, but yeah. I thought that was so funny. You know, there I was 19 years old and, you know, hearing about the people just like devour and subscribe to these magazines and books and sometimes don't even cook. It's just like the act of reading it. I feel similarly. I tend to go through phases with what I'm reading at any given time. And I've gone through a couple of phases of reading food memoirs, you know, or just like stories that are kind of part memoir, part cookbook. And I always love those as well.
Yeah, I'm reading one right now. It's Ruth Reichel's book.
Oh my God, she's the best. Which book of hers are you reading?
It's the one about the recipes that saved her life.
Mm-hmm.
It's about when Gourmet magazine closed and she went into a big funk. And so she started then just cooking these recipes and turning to her kitchen as therapy, which often for me, the kitchen is my therapy. So it's a book that really sings to my soul, and the recipes are divine. I've just been eating that book up slowly. It's so good.
Yeah, I'm an unbelievable fangirl of hers. She has a couple of other books too that I really loved. One, Garlic and Sapphires. It's about her work when she was the food critic for the New York Times and how she became so well known and recognizable that she had to like really go in disguise, like create these characters and wigs and all kinds of stuff to be able to eat at restaurants and not be recognized.
Yes.
That one's super interesting. And then her other, her two books, why am I blanking on the name? Tender at the Bone and Comfort Me with Apples. Those memoirs were absolutely just like blew me away.
My favorite memoirs were the Anthony Bourdain stuff.
Yep. Love his stuff. Oh, you and I could geek out about books forever, I feel. This is great.
We could. And I have a thing for bad boys. So, you know, he's kind of, back in the day, he was really bad. And I love his tales of debauch and all the bad things he was doing. So, you know, it's not just the food part I liked reading about. I just like the fact that he's a little edgy. I dig that.
Yeah. The thing I find that I like the most about stories with food is, regardless of how different our lives might be, everyone eats, right? Like food is a really common denominator. And obviously that can show up in a lot of different ways, you know, in food in your culture and food, you know, whatever. But the fact that it is a common denominator and it's like something that everyone can relate to, even if their experiences are really different. I like stories that are shaped around something that at the heart of it, kind of we all do.
Absolutely. And everyone in our family, well, I mean, in my immediate family, we all love to cook. And because food for us, we didn't get along as a family, but you sat us at the table and there was the one time of the day that we could get along. And we bond over our holiday meals or over the times we get together, you know, just for maybe a simple celebration. So with my siblings, we found that food is the one thing we can all agree on. We love to eat. We love to cook.
Have there been any traditions, food traditions, meal traditions from when you guys were younger that have carried over into your adult lives?
Well, we've all kind of branched off and kind of done our own thing. I tend to be the fancy cooker in the family. My brother is the king of the grill. And my sister has moved up to Canada and she married an Italian. And she's become quite like the Italian, and we grew up on really typical German-American fare. So we've all kind of splintered off into these different things. But one tradition that we did carry on is what we started doing years ago at my parents' for Christmas Eve when we all became adults. Instead of getting together for a big Christmas meal, we would all bring appetizers. And we'd bring a variety of different appetizers. And so that was a more fun and varied way of doing our Christmas Eve. And that tradition has carried on. So my brother and I, every year, we get together, since both of our parents are passed on, and we have an appetizer Christmas Eve, and it's quite lovely.
That's fun. Yeah, I always like hearing the evolution of food traditions. Especially if the way, you know, for me with my personal experience, I eat very differently now than I did when I was growing up or, you know, than my parents still do. And, you know, it's, there's so much sentimentality related to food and so much emotion there that, you know, even as, you know, for me kind of becoming vegan and going through what that, why I was making those choices and, you know, what that meant to me,
yeah.
Still there was really an element of grief with losing traditions or certain foods, you know, that were really important to me as a child.
Yes.
Which I think is something that people don't really talk about, right? Like when you're making, even if you want to make the change that you're making, that there's still kind of a sense of loss there. And I felt it most strongly around Thanksgiving. That's my favorite holiday. I just have always loved it. I've always been the one that, you know, that cooks it. And, you know, it took kind of developing new traditions with my husband where obviously, you know, we're not making turkey. So, okay, this last year, I think I made 13 dishes, just side dishes, desserts. And we watched all the Thanksgiving episodes of Friends. And it's, you know, you have to kind of let traditions evolve as well, which, you know, has been fun.
Oh, yeah. My mother, when she had, we had our Thanksgiving, of course, too. That's my favorite holiday. I now cook our Thanksgiving dinner. But my Thanksgiving dinner is very different than my mother's because I tend, again, to get a little kind of fancy pants here. And also, I don't like pie. I do not like it. I don't eat it. I never liked pie. That's not the kind of dessert I go for. So now that my family's stuck with me behind the helm here on Thanksgiving, they don't get pie. They get things like a cookies and cream cheesecake or, you know, some kind of other, again, creamy dessert. I just don't do pie. So that's one thing I've definitely not carried forward.
That's so funny. I love it. So you mentioned with your siblings being a little splintered, spread out, you said your sister moved. Where are you living now?
I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And is that where you grew up?
I actually grew up in a rural area outside of Milwaukee. So I grew up out in the boonies, and I have to say that was not a good environment for someone like me. I did not fit in. And I thought when I was about 12, I said, as soon as I can get to a city, I am never looking back. And so as soon as I was old enough, I got myself to a city, and I've lived in Milwaukee for most of my life. I also lived in New York for a little while, and that's where I tend to be happiest. And actually, Milwaukee's quite a nice city to live in.
Interesting. So where in New York did you live when you lived there?
I lived on the Lower East Side for about a year and a half.
Okay. So short stint. What brought you there?
I always wanted to go to New York. I was obsessed with it. I still am. And New York was something for me. As soon as I hit 12 years old, what happened is I discovered the Sex Pistols. And this was back in the 70s before it was cool. And I was devouring magazines, reading about the clubs in New York, which is pretty weird for a kid out in a rural area to find this stuff. But I was a very curious gal, and I found out about them. And I was reading all about, you know, Johnny Thunders and the New York Dolls and the Sex Pistols and the Ramones. And I remember saying, I got to get to New York. I just got to get there. And so my plan at right around 12 or 13 was, I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to go there. I'm going to be a makeup artist. I'm going to hang out with these musicians. That's all I wanted to do. And so, of course, when I was old enough, I did end up going out there for a little while. By that time, most of these musicians were either dead or moved on. So that part didn't work out quite well. And I stayed out there for about a year and a half. And then my dad got really, really sick. And we thought he was going to die. So I knew I had to move back because family loyalty is important to me. And he ended up surviving and living for many, many more years after that. So I feel that it was meant to be that I came back here.
And so you've been back ever since?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. As soon as he got sick like that, it was like, no question about it. I'm not going to sit out there and fiddle around. I'm going to get back here and make sure he's okay and that mom has support. So that totally altered my decision and my path.
Yeah, it's so interesting, those kind of inflection points that do that. The reason I asked about New York is because that's where I grew up. So I'm always curious, people's, especially if they were in New York for a short period of time, kind of what their New York story was. So,
oh my God, I love New York. I was there in the 80s and it was so nice and decadent and scary. And now it's so cleaned up and I hate it so much. I still love New York, but I'm like, oh my God, they made it kid friendly. Yikes.
That's so funny. I lived there when I was young. I was born in LA, but yeah, I don't really remember that. We moved to New York when I was very young and lived there for a while, lived in London, and then, you know, kind of bounced around a bit, but went to college in New York and, you know, was there for a part of my younger adult life. But it's funny, I almost had the opposite situation from you, where I only ever lived in really big cities. So that was my entire experience as a child. And now I'm living in Bend, Oregon. And even this, I'm like, can we move more into the woods than this? It's always funny. Like, I think where you wind up, either, you know, as the opposite of what you grew up with, or, you know, try to follow in those footsteps.
Yeah, it's so funny because my brother lives in a small town, which is, it's a bigger town than the one we grew up in. It was pretty rural where we grew up. And my sister lives right outside of Montreal, which is, you know, very chic, very cosmopolitan. She's in a suburb, though. So she's actually doing the suburb life. So we have one in the suburbs, one in the town, and then we have one here in the city.
So if any of you ever get bored, you can go to where the other one is for a visit and the other kind of culture.
Well, I love going to Montreal when I can because it's a good eating city. So once again, it comes back to food. I've had some of the most memorable things to eat in Montreal. Oh,
yeah,
so good.
I plan entire trips around food. So like you're definitely preaching to the choir for sure. my husband grew up in, you know, a tiny kind of middle of nowhere town. And, you know, now where we're living is kind of like a middle ground between where he grew up and where I grew up. And we're going back to New York this summer for my father's 80th birthday. And my husband's never really spent time in New York. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, there's so many amazing restaurants, even especially vegan restaurants, because that's a side of the city that I never explored when I lived there because these changes came afterwards. And so I'm already feeling stressed out. Like, we're only going to be there for this many days and that's this many meals. And here's where I'm going to go. He's like, just relax.
It's a totally vegan-friendly city. It's on the cutting edge of a lot of the vegan fare. So is Portland. Portland, I found, is very good for vegan, vegetarian fare. But New York, you can't go wrong there either. I mean, you are going to you're not going to run out of things to eat in New York. It doesn't matter what kind of diet you're on, what your preferences are. You will never run out of things to eat in New York.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had a trip to New York once that I took with my girlfriend, Rachel. And we, I mean, basically what we did was eat and then just walk around the city until we were hungry enough to eat again. And then just keep walking so we can get hungrier so we can eat more food.
Oh, yes. And there's wonderful ramen restaurants there. My favorite ramen restaurant in the whole world is Momofuku. And I believe they do a vegan fare there. So if you can get to Momofuku on the Lower East Side, please do. You will love it.
Yeah, I mean, I went there a long time ago, but yeah, that's add that to my list. Stop adding things to my list. I'm already stressed out enough. So funny. So, okay. So where you mentioned, that the small town that you grew up in, you said, so I don't remember your exact phrasing, but something like it was hard for someone like me. Can you say more about what that means?
Absolutely. I always felt like an alien. And I felt like an alien in my own family too. And I can actually attribute the alien in my own family thing to a very specific incident. When I was 2 years old, what happened is I broke my leg. I was playing Roadrunner and jumped, and this is why they tell you not to watch those violent cartoons. I was playing Roadrunner, I jumped off the couch, and I was a very precocious little 2 year old and broke my leg. So I was in the hospital, and back in the day, this is back in the 60s, remember? I was in traction for 6 weeks, and my parents had to leave me there. And while they had to leave me there, my mother was also giving birth to my sister. So I remember my mother coming down. She showed me, here's your new sister, and left. And that's pretty traumatic for a little two-year-old. So I remember the incident. I can remember the hospital, everything perfectly. And what ended up happening from that, I ended up learning how to read. I came out of the hospital reading, you know, at a very great level, thanks to Sesame Street and having nothing to do but read books. And I came home then and felt really kind of out of place in my family. So that was a vibration that I remember feeling very, very early on. And when I started school, I also ended up feeling very much like an alien. I've always been a nonconformist. I'm very independent. I was an extremely independent child, which, believe it or not, my parents, boy, they did not like that when I got to be a certain age. I had a lot of independent bad ideas. So super independent. I just thought for myself. I just never felt like I fit in. And where I grew up, being in a small town, conformity is very important to small towns. You know, fitting in with the culture. And I just didn't. I just couldn't relate. So it was a very hard experience because I just felt like I'm in the wrong family. I'm in the wrong place. I need to be somewhere else. And so that's what I meant. It was really a sense of alienation. So I had a lot of very lonely times.
Do you remember the period of time in which that changed? Like, was there a situation maybe in New York or otherwise where you thought, okay, now I feel like maybe I do belong here? Or what was that like?
Yes. As soon as I landed in New York, I'm like, this is where I'm meant to be. I knew it right away. I felt totally at home. I made friends really easily. I still got friends in New York that are my friends for life. And don't get me wrong, I did have friends when I was in high school. So in high school, I did a little bit better. And I know most people have a terrible high school experience, and I had my moments there too. But through like the theater groups and the art classes, I actually was able to connect with a few people who are also still my friends to this day. I'm really into long-term relationships, by the way. When I make a friend with somebody, I tend to be friends for life. And so I'm still friends with those guys. And when I went to New York, it was so easy for me to make friends. It was just really simple. And the fashion, and I love the edge of New York. I just felt like I didn't stand out in a weird way. I could just kind of do my thing and nobody gave a rip about it. So I enjoyed that very much.
Yeah, I'm always interested in people's kind of stories of what home means to them, right? Like finding a place where they feel like they fit in, and whether that's, you know, with their family of origin or not. Because I think a lot of, even as an adult too, the struggle of trying to create that for yourself, create kind of like the culture and environment in which you feel like you belong. So it's yeah, comforting for me to kind of hear you talk about this kind of stuff.
I like the idea of belonging, but not having to totally fit in. Because nonconformity is very important to me. Independence is extremely important to me. I never want to feel like I'm in some cookie cutter restrained thing, or like I have to put on some kind of a thing just to make myself palatable for people. I like to be around a very diverse group of people and have us all not necessarily agree or look the same or anything like that, but if we can find common ground or a way to dig and respect each other, I love that feeling.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm curious where in the timeline you first became interested in tarot.
Well, tarot I became interested in as a teenager. Actually, the funny thing is my mother was extremely intuitive, very, very psychic. And she was one of those people that she would have these dreams and premonitions and lots of superstitions. And my grandmothers were the same way. They were not tarot card readers. You know, they were very simple farm folk, but they had this interest in all those types of things. If you came in and you said, oh my God, I got a bad feeling about something, they're going to pay a lot more attention to that than if you sat down with a scientific formula. So growing up in that kind of environment, it was always kind of a thing where we could honor our intuition. It was never looked at as something, you know, off. So I was very fortunate with that. Anyhow, when I was a teenager, of course, as any teenager, we're always looking to find ourselves. And I was trying to understand, who am I? Why do I not feel like these other people around me? What's going on here? And I had a friend. She's my best friend. She actually lives in Portland. And her mother was this really unusual woman. In fact, my best friend was homeschooled, which back in the day, that was kind of like, whoa, this is weird. And so, of course, her and I got along. And her mother was a psychologist, but she also had a keen interest in astrology. And so my girlfriend said, hey, she wants to look at your chart. And I said, sure. And she sat out, laid out my chart, and started explaining some things to me. And I'm like, wow, this actually makes a lot of damn sense. I'm going to learn some astrology. So what I did then is I started learning where I could. Now, back in the day, you know, we're talking again back in late 70s, early 80s, there wasn't a whole lot, especially out in a rural area. So I was pretty much TSOL. I had very little to go on. But I did have one of her books, which I still have the book to this day. And so I started learning from that book. And I was at a bookstore on one of the rare occasions we went out to the mall. And there was a bookstore back then called Walden Books. And I walked in and I was going to get myself a new astrology book. I saved up my money. And I was 15 at the time. And I looked and I saw a tarot deck. And I thought, I saw this in a movie. I'm going to pick up that tarot deck. So instead of getting the astrology book, I picked up the tarot deck. And I went home. And by the way, back then, you had very, very, very limited selection of books you could get on tarot, astrology, and there were very few tarot decks that were out there in print. So the deck I had was called the Marseilles deck, which is probably one of the hardest tarot decks to learn. But it was all that was there. So I got the deck, went home, started practicing with a little white book and, you know, playing with my sister. And we were like, hey, this stuff really works. This is really insightful. So it began developing from there. And a couple months later, we were at that bookstore again. And I went right back to that New Age section. And there was the Rider-Waite Tarot. And I looked at that. I'm like, I'm going to get this deck. And so I got that deck. And that deck sang to me. I put my Marseilles deck away. I really got into the Rider-Waite. And I just started doing it on anybody who would let me. So it was really pretty much kind of accidental.
That's so interesting. So I'd love to back up a minute. For anyone who isn't familiar with tarot, can you give an overview maybe of what it is and how it works, if that's the right phrasing?
Yeah, sure. I think there are a lot of different schools of thoughts and people have very different ways that they read. You know, one of the beautiful things is there's a lot of diversity now, which I totally love. But basically what tarot is, it's a deck with 78 images. It's divided into a couple different categories. You have your major arcana, which shows the bigger picture in life and fate. You have the minor arcana, which shows our day-to-day activity. And you have the court cards, which shows the players in that or the energy that we are presenting. And the way tarot works is you're shuffling the cards, you're laying them out, you're studying them, and then you're looking at what is the story that these cards are telling and how does it apply to me and how does it apply to where I might be going? What is this telling me? So they're more or less, they're kind of like a tool that can give you insights into what's going on in your life. They can give you insights into what may be coming so you can really be conscious of the decisions you're making. And they can also be a wonderful way to tap into your creativity. So tarot is really pretty much a tool to start working with your intuition and to become more aware.
Yeah, I love that. What do you think are some of the maybe misconceptions or misunderstandings that people have of tarot or maybe of your work in general?
I think there's a lot of misconceptions about tarot. So many. I mean, first of all, there are people who think it's somehow it's evil, and it's not. It's really simply just a tool. There's nothing evil about it. I like to say it's like a hammer, right? A hammer can be used to hang a beautiful picture, but it can also be used to like knock somebody in the head. It's going to depend on your intention. There's nothing evil about it. If you're using tarot as a tool to help and to guide, it can be the most fabulous ally in any kind of healing work you're doing or, you know, how you're looking to live your life. So I look at it as a wonderful tool. I don't see it as anything negative about it whatsoever. I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions. Another misconception people have is that you have to be gifted to read tarot, that somehow you've got to be this, you know, great big psychic. And that's not true at all. Anybody can learn to read tarot. I really firmly believe that. Now, there's some of us that have a knack for it. It's kind of like a musician. My son, when he was 2 years old, he was moving in perfect time. Not 2 years old. He was like 2 months old. Excuse me. Moving in perfect time to rhythm of a song. And I remember like looking and saying, you know, this kid will probably be a drummer one day. Well, my son is a classically trained drummer to this day. I have no sense of rhythm. I might be able to learn how to play an instrument, but I don't have that. He has that. It's the same with tarot. It's an instrument. Anyone can learn it. And some people just can really make it sing. So I think those are two of the biggest misconceptions about it.
Yeah, I'm really curious. I mean, I have so many questions. Like, I'm completely fascinated by what you do and having done an email reading with you that it's funny, actually, I should tell that story. I was trying to remember how I first heard of you. I think it was through Alex Franzen. Probably.
Right.
If I'm correct, you know, it was, oh, Teresa's so awesome. You know, you should get a reading from her. And, you know, I was kind of new into even learning what that was. And when I saw that you did things that weren't just in person, because I always assumed it was just an in-person process, but the fact that you did phone readings and email readings, I thought that that was so neat and accessible. And that was when I had spent about a year and a half wanting to start this very podcast, actually. Yes. And I had a lot of uncertainty around it. And, you know, so that's, I don't remember the exact specific question that I asked in the reading that we did, but, you know, the response that you gave me, you know, is this very long, very, you know, well, I don't know what I was expecting, honestly, going into it, but it completely blew my expectations. And it was so helpful. And it was such actionable information. And the part of that reading that I still think about all the time is, I could pull it out. I have it somewhere, but that you said that in the timeline for the podcast really kind of like hitting its stride or, you know, making the effect that I hope that it makes, that it would be 2 years. And so I started this last August, and that's been actually really comforting for me. Anytime I get frustrated with, you know, it should be here. I should be there. Just relax, Nicole. Like, you haven't even come. You're not even at the 1 year mark yet, yet alone the 2 year
right.
mark. And so I don't know, that provides a lot of comfort for me.
It absolutely can provide comfort, and it can also sometimes motivate people to making different changes, you know, to like shift gears if need be. So I just find it to be absolutely just a wonderful, wonderful thing to have by your side. You know, it's really funny. Most of my work for years, I've been reading tarot now professionally for about 25 years, so a long time. This has been the, you know, longest career thing I've done. And it was always face-to-face in the beginning. I did a lot of parties. I did a lot of like appearances at, you know, different events. I did a lot of work in my office, one-on-one, face-to-face. And years ago, one of my clients, who was an elderly lady, broke her hip. I've got a wonderful bunch of elderly ladies. They're so awesome. And she had broken her hip, and she called me, and she says, I'm never going to be able to get up those stairs again. Can you please try to do it over the phone? And I said, you know what, let's try it. What the hey? And we tried it, and it worked great. So the next thing I knew, her friends and her all switched over to the phone. because they're like, we don't want to drive down there, and this is so convenient for us. And they absolutely became just super, super loyal and spread the word. And, you know, so I started doing a lot more readings over the phone. And when I put up my website to offer it to other people, because now I knew how to do phone readings, I thought, oh, you know, I'll put up the website, we'll put this out there, and I'll offer email readings, and I'll try them out. And the email readings really exploded for me. And people love them because I'm fast, it's very clear, I'm very succinct, and they have a written record. So for people who want a written record that they can look at, who are not audio people, they really find it to be actually quite useful. And it works just as well as seeing people in person. In fact, what's really funny, now that I have the website up for a number of years, a lot of my local clients, not just the elderly people, are like, oh, screw it, I'm not driving down. You can like do this over the phone and then record it. Awesome. So it's really funny. My business is completely flipped.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, and what you said about the written record, I didn't even really think about that until you said it. But it's, I mean, I did. I printed it out and I have it in, you know, it's like one of the most important pieces of paper in my like podcast folder that I keep in my desk drawer that, you know, I'll look at it again sometimes, even just for as a reminder of, okay, yes, this is the work that I'm supposed to be doing right now. It's, I don't know, it's been really nice. I'm curious if you find, I mean, I guess it obviously is successful in person, phone, email. Do you feel like you require different information from people if you're not actually meeting face to face, or what are the differences with the different processes?
You know, here's the thing with this. I'm one of these weirdos that I really don't ask for too much. Now, if I'm doing a phone reading for somebody, I always say, if you want to include your date of birth and a photo of you, a photo's nice if I don't know someone, because then I quickly look at it. I don't sit and look at it during the reading. I just quickly look at it. I'm like, okay, let me just connect with that person. It does help. You know, photos are a wonderful visual aid, but some people are not comfortable with that. And I'm like, that's okay. You don't need to send it. If you feel weird about it, just show up with an open mind. That's all I ask. And as long as they're in a quiet environment and they're open, the phone works brilliantly, even with no information provided. Now, for email readings, because it's written, I do require a specific question because it's a very different energy that I'm working with, as weird as that sounds. So it really helps me to zero in. For me to do something like a general outlook on the email reading, it just doesn't wash. It doesn't work well for that. I want a specific question because the email readings, again, are designed to be concise and swift. I need that. I do like it if they send a picture, but oftentimes people, again, if they don't feel comfortable, that's totally fine. Then just forget about it. Just give me a specific question so I have something to work with here. And then I just go from there.
And what's the value of people providing their birth date, birth information?
It just gives me two different things. One, I can just feel the, I mean, it sounds kind of woo-woo now. I'm going to sound a little bit freaky, but let me just back up a second. I'm very much into feeling energy. And for some people, that sounds really kind of creepy, but I believe everything is energetic. Everything is made of energy. And people have a certain vibration. And sometimes just I'll look at the birth date, I can feel kind of like a little something here, as weird as it sounds. Looking at a picture helps. So it's an energetic thing for me. But also sometimes I'll use the astrology birth date, like for timing. If someone's asking for timing of something, I'll quickly whip up a chart and I'll look to see if there's any timing that I prefer for them so I can pick an auspicious date. In fact, you want to hear something really funny. I've had some clients over the years who have gotten C-sections who've asked me to pick the ideal time to do their C-section to make sure they get, you know, a kid that they get along with. So I've done that too.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, when, you know, you kind of said, this might sound weird or this might sound woo-woo, maybe it does to someone, not to me. I'm like completely into this. So on the bandwagon of this. And that's, well, the energetic nature of what I would assume kind of your work is, that's why I asked the difference between in-person versus, you know, because I would assume that you have a different experience of someone's energy sitting face-to-face with them versus maybe another medium.
It's very different when you sit in front of somebody face-to-face, but then when you do it over the email. But I got to tell you, people's vibrations and their intentions oftentimes come through loud and clear through that keyboard. Even if they're putting their words in the most certain sounding way, if you're sensitive to energy, you're going to pick up on what's really going on behind that motive.
Yeah, I, you know, the experience from my own life that I can use to relate to this is with the podcast. My good friend Julia, she has a show called Running on Ohm, and I'm a reoccurring guest on her show, and she does all of her interviews and conversations in person. She started out doing by Skype, and that didn't feel right for her, and she likes the connection that happens when you're recording in person, which, you know, I totally understand. But it's so funny when we talk, because I do all of mine over Skype, and part of that is just a convenience. I don't really love traveling. I don't want to be traveling all the time, but also I actually prefer this. Like, I love talking on the phone with people, and this setup for me, I actually get a better sense of someone when I can, you know, like when you're talking, my eyes are closed, I'm listening to you, which is something that I would feel strange doing in person, because eye contact is such a big part of the experience.
Yep.
So it is, yeah, it is funny. At any, when I used to do kind of one-on-one coaching, which I don't do anymore, it was all phone work. And for me, that actually worked better. Not that I don't enjoy being in person with people, I do, but I find that I get a better sense of who someone is talking this way. Even that's why I don't do, you know, obviously we're talking on Skype, but we don't have video on, like the audio.
Yep.
It works better for me. So I understand what you're saying.
Actually, it works better for me too, because let me tell you something. With tarot, I don't like to be distracted. I like to be really zoned in, and I'm very, very good at being zoned in. Even though I do have a lot of ADHD here, when I do a reading, I'm locked into that reading completely. And one of the things I find when I'm face to face with somebody, when I'm reading the cards, I'm looking at the cards. I'm not looking at the client. So, you know, when I'm on the phone, I'm pretty much doing the same thing as I do in person. And once in a while, when I'm doing an in-person reading, I'll look up, I'll just point out a certain thing and make sure I'm connecting. But the reason why I don't like to look at people when I'm doing the reading, I want to focus on those cards and the vibe I'm feeling. And I don't want to like look for validation or anything. I just want to go with what I'm feeling. And I know that sounds really weird, especially because a lot of tarot readers, they're taught that you should ask for validation and you should do things like say, does this sound right? Does this make sense? So, you know, you're guided in the reading, and I don't work like that. I never got formal training, by the way. I want to just be purely telling people what I see and feel so they know it's coming from me. Now, that doesn't mean I don't want their backstory. If you're going to give me a backstory or tell me a specific question, that's fine. But when I'm doing that reading, I am just purely doing my reading, very much like a basketball player is just firmly focused on putting that ball in the hoop, and they're not worried about the people who are cheering or booing in the stands.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and what you said about being easily distractible, I'm the same way. It's funny. I'm kind of laughing, looking around my little home office. You know, I have these two big, wonderful windows, you know, that look out and trees and everything. And I have to have my blinds closed while I'm doing something like this. Like if, you know, when I'm recording for the podcast, it's everything is basically like centered on this. If, you know, if the blinds are open and a car goes by, or, you know, one of the outdoor cats wanders or something, like it completely throws me off. Like I need to be, it's the reason that I can't get anything done in coffee shops, or which actually makes me think, you know, with the work that you do, my guess is that you have to create, I don't know if a specific environment is the right word, but strong boundaries for yourself in order to preserve your energy, preserve kind of whatever inner calm, inner peace it takes to do this work. And I would love to hear kind of what that looks like for you.
Boundaries have been my major life lesson. It has been probably the lesson I struggle with the most, and the lesson that I'm always having to work on a conscious basis. You know, I grew up in a household with, we had a bunch of people in the house. I had siblings. My grandmother lived with us. It was a house where there wasn't a whole lot of privacy or respect for boundaries. So growing up, that has been probably the bane of my existence, learning how to establish good boundaries. And with my work, it's very easy in this work to get your boundaries stepped on. So I've had to, as a business person, really set up some hardcore boundaries. And sometimes people think I'm a bitch. And it's like, no, I'm not a bitch. I'm trying to preserve my energy, and I want to be able to show up for the right people and show up 100%. And I can't do that if I'm feeling like a threat or I'm feeling like I'm not being respected. So boundaries as a business person and as a person in general has been one of the very, very, you know, biggest struggles for me. I still have to work on it. And protecting my energetic boundaries when I'm working with clients also requires a lot of things. You know, I used to do a lot of parties a lot of tarot parties, and they're very good financially, but they were very hard for me because I am so sensitive. I'm so sensitive to boundaries. I'm very sensitive to rudeness. Any type of rudeness or pushiness or aggression, it makes me feel like I am under attack, like a kind of like a cat in a corner with a pit bull. And it just wasn't a very good experience for me. I'm entertaining at parties, but they're very hard for me. And I'm also an introvert, which people don't realize because I'm friendly. But I'm extremely introverted. I love being by myself, which I always say I don't make a very good marriage partner, but I love being by myself. I like being one-on-one. I'm intimate. That's my jam. And so when I'm working with clients, I have to have the right environment. I have to write the right energy, the right types of clients. And my office is cozy. It's warm. It's got lots of sunlight. It's got all the things around me that make me happy. And I have to have that. I love it when people come in. We got a candle burning. We're chilling out in my big fluffy chairs. And I'm comfortable. And I'm in my yoga pants. I can breathe in yoga pants. And then I can show up 100% without feeling threatened. And it's the same when I'm doing a phone reading or an email reading. My environment, it's a little bit more cluttery than I wish it was, but it has all the things around me that make me happy. I have my pictures of my cats wearing Victorian clothes. I have my picture of Jay-Z and Rick Ross right above my desk so I can look at them for inspiration when I'm doing email readings. I have the things around me that make me happy, that make me feel safe so that I can create that safe container for my clients. And you know, tarot ultimately, what we're doing is really intimate work. And people come here oftentimes, and sometimes it's people who have nowhere else to go, and they're coming here with some really vulnerable stuff. So having that safe space so they can be vulnerable with me, so we can merge and connect and be intimate and share, you have to have the right space for it. And I've learned over the years, boy, when I'm out there in the middle of some crazy party, it doesn't lend very well to that.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of empowerment that can happen from being honest with yourself about what it is that you need to feel good and to be successful. Mm-hmm. And I think this is true, I mean, not just in working environments, but in life in general. And, you know, you mentioned having struggled with boundaries. I've struggled a lot with, I mean, things related to self-care, feeling like kind of the internal story that I've had to work on a lot is this idea that, well, Nicole, you shouldn't need this, this, or this in order to be able to perform well, right? That this, I have this inherent like rejection of anything that feels high maintenance or needy or something in that space of, you know, you should just be able to write from anywhere, right? Or what's wrong with you that you, you know, this, that, or the other. And it's been really interesting to kind of have to address those stories and to get to the point, place of not only is it fine to need what you need, but that it's like the best thing that we can do is to provide that for ourselves, especially because we're the only, like no one's necessarily going to provide that for you. It's being able to provide that for yourself, I think, is a huge strength.
It is. And it's hard to learn, especially in life or in business. I started my business when I was 27 years old, and it wasn't what I intended to do for a living, believe me. But here I am now. I've been at this. I'm 50 years old. I'll be 51 in just about 2 months here. And in the beginning, I didn't know what the heck I was doing with this boundary stuff. I put myself in situations that were really, really uncomfortable. And I look back now and I'm like, I'm so glad I did it. It made me a much hardier tarot reader. But as I got older, I became a lot more aware of my needs. And I think that's very hard to do sometimes when you're young or if you grow up in a household like I did where boundaries are not really respected. And it really took a lot of being in business for many years and dealing with certain types of situations before I began to really recognize that I deserve to feel respected and I deserve to feel safe and secure. And I'm going to do things now that are going to allow me to have that container. And that's going to be good for my clients because I will be showing up 100% for them. But it's also going to be good for me because I deserve to run my business and my life in a way that makes sense for me. And it took me getting older to discover that. It's like when I hit 40, something clicked. I'm like, what am I doing here? I don't need to take this. This isn't going to happen in my world anymore. So at that time, I had been in business for, you know, over a decade before I finally started learning about boundaries.
Yeah, I mentioned you know, our friend Alex Franzen before, and she's someone who I really admire when it comes to policies and boundaries. And, you know, she's done some writing on her site about, you know, the kind of evolution that she's gone through of setting what are pretty strict and firm policies as far as, you know, if you buy a ticket to a live event and you can't show up, or, you know, that type of stuff. And I don't know if it was just hearing it at the right time, but I'm curious, what are some specific policies that you've put in place in your business kind of in response to this personal need for boundaries?
First of all, I do want to say that Alexandra Franzen is one of the people I admire the most also. She's been a great friend over the years. She's worked with me for a long time, and I just think I learned so much from her about these things. And I love it to see someone as young as her getting it right off the bat, because I had to learn the hard way. So people like her, I just love them to death, and I just think she's amazing. One of the big, I've got a lot of boundaries. I got lots of rules, which again, sometimes makes people think, wow, what the hell is she? And I don't care anymore. It's like, look, I want to serve who I serve, and I want to serve up and do a good job. One of my biggest, most strictest boundaries is on no-shows. And in my business, and I'm saying this not as a rip on my industry, but tarot is a flaky industry. It's a flaky business. And there's a lot of people who don't take it seriously. I'm not talking peers. I'm talking clients. They'll think like I'm just sitting around with nothing better to do. So yeah, they don't show up and they'll call me 2 days later. This is the way it used to be back in the day. Oh, I'm sorry, the babysitter didn't show. Can we reschedule? You've got to be kidding me. That is so incredibly rude. And I put up with that for a long time. I had one client who would pull that on me all the time. And one day, it's again in my 40s, it snapped. I'm like, I'm not doing this anymore. So I created a policy. You pull a no-show, you don't work with me ever again. Let me tell you, that changed everything.
Yep.
That changed everything. And I had some long-term clients I fired. They were really upset with me. I'm like, tough. You continuously disrespect my time, because when I'm doing these readings, what they don't understand, it's not like I'm sitting here around in PJs all day with nothing better to do. I've got lots of stuff to do. I've got kids. I've got family. I've got three stories of a house that needs to be cleaned. I've got cats that are high maintenance. I got shit I can be doing, and I can put other people in those spots. So for me, it was always like they were taking money out of my hands, which again, I need to show up for work and get paid. And I'm sitting aside this time for you, and then you don't show and don't even have the courtesy to call or email me. No. So that's the strictest policy. And my clients know it. They know it well. And the wonderful thing now is with PayPal, I have people prepay. So one of the rules also, if you have an appointment and you pull a no-show, I'm sorry, but you get your fee forfeited. And we don't work together. Now, if you give me plenty of notice and I can slide someone in there, we don't have a problem. And I usually can slide someone in when someone gives me 24-hour notice. I have a wait list, so I have no problem filling those spots if I just have the common courtesy of a simple 24-hour notice. All it takes is 1 second to send me an email or phone call. So that's one policy that I'm super, super clear on, is my time. Because the one thing here is my time is the one thing that is finite, and I am getting older. And so my time becomes way more precious the older I get. That clock is ticking. So I am very big on policies around my time.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think we teach people how to treat us, right? So like on one hand, while it might seem, you know, someone would come across your policies and, you know, oh, this is a lot or this is strict, as a client or someone who has and, you know, would want to continue working with you, I actually really appreciate that, because I think that boundaries and structure are helpful. I actually don't respond well when things are like very loosey-goosey. Like I like to know like what's expected of me. And even in terms of, you know, it's funny, obviously, you know, this now being a guest on this podcast, you know, I had been a guest on, you know, a bunch of other shows and done other, you know, things with wonderful people over the years. And I always want to do the best job that I can as a guest, right? Like give them what they're looking for, do that. And I would go into some of these things feeling, I don't know if unprepared is the right word, but I always wanted more information from them on, because it's their show, it's their audience. They know more, you know, what they're looking for. And so when I started my podcast, I was like, okay, this might be so crazy, but I'm going to put together like a prep page for guests that basically has a, here's how we can do an awesome show together. Everything from, you know, the simple kind of technical, wear headphones, use Ethernet instead of Wi-Fi if possible. And then just kind of a tell stories, do that, you know, just like laying out what I think makes a good show. And I was kind of hesitant at first, are people going to think this is so crazy? But I was like, no, this is what I want as a guest, is for someone to tell me what to do, how to show up, you know, what, if they say they want a photo, okay, well, what kind of photo do they want? Or what, you know, it's actually, I think, really helpful that you have boundaries in place, you know, that someone knows how to interact with you.
Well, yeah. And also here's the other thing with it. For people who don't like it, it also sends them a signal that, wow, I don't want to work with this person. And then they can find someone who's more appropriate for them. For example, I have a new boundary in place for in-person sessions now. It used to be anybody could come in person. Then as business got a lot crazier, it became you need to have a valid referral. And last year I had a couple incidents that were a little bit unsettling. So I decided there's a new policy now. New policy, if you are a new client, first timer, your first session with me will be over the phone so I can feel you out. And that way we can see if we're compatible. And then your next session is fine coming in person. And, you know, that may sound like it's a bit weird, but I want to feel safe. Again, it all comes down to me creating a safe container, and I want my clients to feel safe. And so there's been some clients, potential clients, who've balked at that. They didn't like that. They just want to come in here. They don't want to have to be screened. And that's great. I'm like, no problem. Let me refer you to places that do walk-ins. And then they go and they find their walk-in and they don't have to obey the rules and they're fine. So it does screen people out to have rules in place. Because if you find that, wow, this person doesn't sound like someone I like or whatnot, the beautiful thing is then, no offense, there's other people who are going to work better for you. So putting those policies and rules in place, it also helps your clients self-select.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah,
I'm not for everybody. I'm not for everyone. You know, not everyone's going to like my style. And if I'm not your style, you know, there's certain things that are not my style. I don't wear dresses very often. You're not going to find me at the dress barn. That's just not my thing. And I know that. It says dress barn right there. It's very clear what they're providing. So I know, that doesn't work for me. I can go down to the Gap and get some jeans.
Absolutely. I mean, I actually want to underscore this point that you're making because I think that it's so important and, you know, appropriate for all different businesses and especially, you know, people who are solo entrepreneurs who work for themselves. This, I think there's a fear, or at least I can speak to my experience. There was a fear for me at the beginning, you know, of what I was doing. And obviously my business has evolved, but that I didn't want to alienate anyone or I didn't want, you know, you want to not put a policy into place that, you know, is going to mean someone doesn't want to work with you because you need the money or, you know, that kind of stuff. And while I think there's a little bit of validity that I actually have found that the opposite is really true. Like I thought about this, you know, back when I used to blog and coach at the same time, you know, I would definitely have some people that didn't like that I swear in my writing and, you know, or even in kind of like the name of the blog at that point. And for me, I'm like, that's awesome. Because I mean, if they're going to take the time to email me and tell me they're offended, I mean, that's their jam, I guess. But for me, it's more like, you know, they'd say things like, you know, I would have hired you as a coach if you, you know, if you didn't sound so unladylike or whatever they want to say. And I'm like, do you know how many coaches are out there? Do you know how many people you can work with? It's actually so awesome that you're turned off by what I'm doing because then we wouldn't work well together. Right. So I think this idea of like being who you are and putting these policies or, you know, whatever in place and being as kind of authentic as possible is going to draw in the people who are totally obsessed with what you're doing and that it's going to be a great fit and that it's going to be an automatic filter for people that would wind up like being really frustrating clients.
You know, that's so true. And when I was first in my tarot business, I assumed I had to help everybody. And I realized that there are some people, again, that are really just not the right fit for me. Some people want a completely different tarot experience than the one I offer. And so I want to make sure then if they come to me and we're not a good fit, that I send them to someone who is. I know everybody in my industry and I love my peers. And there is nothing better than sending people to the right person. For example, one thing I don't do is emergency readings. Now, emergency reading is somebody who needs to get into my office today because something crazy is going on. It usually has something to do with a lost love. Let me just preface that. And I can't do emergency. I don't want to feel pressured. I can do something in 48 hours, but you want me to drop everything on the spot? I don't do that. But I do have a wonderful list of tarot readers I know who do offer same day, I'll get you in emergency services. I've been sending, for example, there's one guy, his name is Paris. He has a website, Tarot by Paris, and he does emergency readings. I've sent some people there. They've been delighted. They've been thrilled. And, you know, he's thrilled. They're thrilled. I'm thrilled. We're all happy. Does that mean I'm losing business? No, it means I'm making sure people are being taken care of. So that's how I look at it. And the way I really learned this, actually, was from my yoga business, because the other thing I do is I have a little yoga studio. It's a mini studio, and it's been going for 12 years now. And when I started the studio, I had a vision of how I wanted to work. I was super clear on my yoga studio, more clear than I was on my tarot business at the time. Remember, I was learning boundaries back then. And I was talking to some guy, and he said, well, what are you going to do to market? I said, oh, it's going to be a small studio, and I only want to work with people who hate going to regular studios. And he said, what? You ain't going to have any business. And I said, I know what I'm doing here. I know exactly what I want. And so the website for the studio turns people off right away, because it's basically saying, hey, we might listen to Eminem in class, and we talk during class, and, you know, I make it really clear that this is not a place if you're coming for a yoga workout. And I turn off every one of those people. On a rare occasion, somebody like that comes into my studio and they quickly realize, holy crap, this is the studio for misfit yogis. And they go away and they don't come back. My specialty for yoga is working with people who don't fit into these studios, and or people who are injured or stiff. So often what I get are students who are, they might be overweight, they might have a physical condition, they might just not want to wear shorts in a yoga class, or they want to talk during class, and they want to make friends. So we've got this weird little studio, but you know the funny thing is, it's full. It's been full since day one. I have students who've been with me since the beginning who beg me not to close the studio. It's because it's the right fit for them. They would never go anywhere else.
Yeah, I'm actually feeling a lot of envy that we don't live in the same city, because that sounds I am definitely one of those people who has like really tried to love going to yoga, and I don't for any number of reasons. But yeah, that actually sounds fantastic. So on the boundaries subject, this is maybe diverting a little bit, but I'm curious if you've ever had incidents or needed to set boundaries, kind of separating client relationships from friendships. And I ask because, you know, doing what you do, something that's, I think would be of a lot of interest to people. Do you find that the line gets blurred with friends, just like normal friend talk versus them wanting you to kind of read for them for free, if that makes sense?
Back in the day, that used to be a problem. I used to have a few particular clients who, and I'm very friendly. And, you know, often you can't help it. You sometimes become friends with your clients. In fact, I've got a client who's been with me from the beginning, and her and I go out to eat. Her husband and I, we go out to eat all the time. I love these guys. But when it comes time for work, they know they're going to pay me for it. They're not going to ask to just toss a couple of cards. But that's something I had to integrate with people, because there were some that would do that. They'd call and say, could you just toss a couple of cards? Never offer to pay, et cetera, until I started saying, well, if you'd like a session with me, we can book a session. And that pretty much nipped into the bud. I don't have people who do that to me anymore. And people have learned that would be the same like going to a doctor at a cocktail party and asking him to diagnose your knee issue. People get that. And I don't seem to have too much of a problem. I read for a lot of my friends, and a lot of my clients become friends. When I am in reading mode, I'm in a very, very different mode. In fact, I read for my daughter all the time. My daughter used to go to other tarot readers, and I used to say, just go get a reading from so-and-so, you know? And after a while, she's like, you know, I just prefer coming here, because you're straight up, and that's what my daughter likes. She hated it when she was growing up, but she likes it now as an adult woman. So I read for her, for example, all the time, and I'm the only reader she'll go to now.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's funny that you use the doctor and the cocktail party example, because as you were talking, the thing that came into my head is, you know, if you're friends with a surgeon, you're not just going to be like, hey, can you just like cut me open a little bit? Like just.
Yeah, I mean, he does that. But people do assume sometimes, because, you know, tarot is this kind of funky thing, and it's a little woo-woo, and it's fun and all of that. they assume certain things, and people assume also that you're always tuned in all the time, 24/7. And it's like, look, I'm very sensitive and I'm sensitive to energy, but if I'm at a cocktail party and I've had a glass of wine, I'm going to tell you right now that stuff is all tuned out. I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about Game of Thrones. I don't want to look at your palm or your tarot cards. I want to talk about what's happening. Is Jon Snow alive? So I am in a different zone also when I'm outside of my work.
Right. I mean, and it's using, you know, continuing the surgery analogy, it's the same thing of like the process of like scrubbing up and getting ready, right? Like that it's, but for whatever reason, with some of these like other types of businesses, we don't see the distinction being as clear, right? So you mentioned getting interested or starting with tarot when you were 15. And then I think you said starting your business when you were 27. So I'm curious what kind of the beginning of your working life was like. What were your maybe first job or first couple jobs before you decided to turn this into the business?
Well, I did work in an office. And I worked in an office in New York, too, for a bike messenger firm, which was a great job being around all those guys in spandex. Oh, my God. That job. I also did a little work on an anarchist newspaper. So that was another weird little job I had. You know, I just kind of had jobs like that. And I moved back from New York, and I'm like, okay, I don't want to do office work anymore, even though, first of all, there's no way in hell I was going to find a job as cool as that. That was one of the best jobs ever. And I'm like, I need to figure out something I'm going to do with myself. And so I got a job as a bartender. And I thought, this will be something I can do, even though at the time I didn't even drink. Isn't that weird? But I thought it would be fun. I can bartend, I can waitress, and I'll figure out what I'm going to do here while I get dad well. And so got a part-time job doing that. And it happened that I was put on the most boring schedules because I wasn't a strong bartender. I didn't drink. You know, I didn't know how to mix those drinks. I had to learn. And so I began bringing my tarot cards to the bar. And at that time, I had already been reading cards for like a decade. And I always did them for friends or whoever. And sometimes people would toss me a couple bucks here and there. Well, anyhow, what ended up happening is those days that were dead suddenly became quite busy. And I moved on to a different bar and the people followed me. And I would attract a lot of people to these bars. And so my nights became very, very popular. And I just remember people constantly saying, I would love to pay you for more time. Can we do something outside of this bar? And I would think about, well, let me think about it. And one day I was really thinking about it and I thought, you know, maybe I should consider starting a business, even though I didn't know jack about business and didn't know what the hell I was doing. I thought about it and I had been connected now with my husband then and he said, yeah, you should go do it. So I said to my boss at the bar that I was working at that time that I'm thinking about turning this into a business. And what ended up happening, and I always love telling this story, he went behind my back and told one of the bar patrons that, oh my God, no one's going to pay her for that. She'll fail. And this guy came back and told me that this guy said that. I'm like, oh, really? And there's one thing about me that people should know. If you make a dare, if you tell me I'm going to fail, especially if it comes out of the mouth of a man, because I am a very, again, independent woman. I'm a big time feminist. I said, oh yeah? Bullshit. And I quit my job. And I started my business right from there. And I had those bar patrons who had always wanted to pay me. They right away said, yay. So they started hiring me for parties and I got even little gigs here and there. And that's what started my career. It was this guy telling me I was going to fail. That was the push. That was the push. And it was it. I jumped right in and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I had to figure it out the hard way. But I figured it out and I've been going now for, again, 25 years. Here I am.
Yeah, I love that story. What were kind of some of the early like learning lessons for you, or what were maybe the first 6 months of the business like?
Well, of course, the first 6 months were a bit slow because, you know, I was new. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Then I think about 6 months after that, so it was scary. It was scary. It was nerve-wracking. I didn't have a location. I would read at, you know, people's houses. People would have me come there. So it was a lot of like trying to figure it out. And then after that time, I got a little gig reading one day a week as a special appearance at a bar. That helped a lot. because I was very good for that bar. They got a lot of people coming in, and I did that for a few years. I built up a very good clientele through that. And then those people would take a card. They'd hire me to come to their house for a small gathering. So, you know, it was a lot of that in the beginning. And there was also a little New Age shop that had opened up, and I got a gig reading there once a week. And that also helped me to build up presence and clientele. So I would say the first 3 years were a lot of that. People's houses, the gig at the bar, the gig at the occult shop or metaphysical shop, whatever you want to call it. And then I was finally able to get an office in my home. My husband and I got that all set up. And that really started changing things, because the people who really wanted the privacy and the intimacy were delighted to have a location they could go to. And so then I started doing my office and then doing the parties. And I did that for a very, very long time until I got my website up. And once the website was really rolling, then I finally was able to quit those parties, which was really good for me. So it was a lot of really slowly developing my presence, learning the scary things like taxes and, you know, all of that. It was just a long learning process. So it was long and slow. There was no overnight success. This has been 25 years in the making.
Yeah, I love talking to people who started their businesses offline, right? And
yeah.
Because I think that right now, I mean, it's such a prevalent thing of, you know, having an online business or, you know, doing freelance or working for yourself or whatever, all based around the internet, that I think it's so easy to forget how many businesses got their start and still exist in large part with like nothing to do with social media. Like that, you know, that's real too. It's not that everything happens on the internet.
We didn't have it back in the day. We had to go about things the hard way. Here's the thing though, with the online world, it does make it easier, but even having an online presence doesn't guarantee you're going to be successful. I know plenty of tarot readers who have a plenty sparkling persona online and they are struggling in their businesses. That's not a guarantee that you're going to make it.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I mean, I think that's true in lots of industries, right? People who
yeah.
you know, have the shiny website or whatever. What do you attribute your success to?
Tenacity and consistency. I am like a pit bull. When I log on to something, I don't let go. If I persevere, no matter what. That, and I'll tell you, you want to get a, here's a crazy story about how dedicated I am to my clients. I love my clients. You know, I really do. And I really feel called to serve them. And I will serve them no matter what. That means no matter how sick I am, unless I'm throwing up, I am showing up to work. And my clients know that about me. They know I'm consistent as hell. And so two quick little stories about that. One time I was at a client's house and they said, we have Pizza Hut here. Do you want some Pizza Hut? And I said, no, I'm not into pizza that much. And they said, oh, come on, one slice won't kill you. I said, okay, what the hey. So I ate the slice and I started getting sick a little while later. I got so sick, Nicole, that I turned yellow. I had to crawl up the stairs on my hands and knees. And as sick as I was, I took like one day to try to like handle it. Next day I was back at work, sick as a dog. Because I had clients that had scheduled with me and I was not going to let them down. So my clients know that I'm going to always show up. I'm there for you. The only time I ever think I really goofed a client up and the client got really angry at me until they heard my excuse. I always deliver a fast turnaround. I do email readings within 48 hours. And I had a client who emailed me and they said, it's exactly 48 hours. You didn't get my email reading. I'm very upset. And I said, I'm sorry. I was on my dad's deathbed. I'm going to take care of you right away. And I did.
Mm.
And she felt terrible about it. But so anyhow, my point of that story is I am there. I do the work. I do the work no matter what. I take care of my people. And they know that when they come here. And the consistency is everything is very consistent. My brand is consistent. I'm consistent. My work has been, again, when I make a promise, I take care of it. And I've even had the same phone number for 25 years. I had a client, the other funny story. One day he called and he says, I hear this message. It's a client I did a reading for years ago. And I get this message and he says, the message is, oh my God, the number still works. You're still here. And I'm like, yes. And he said, I had a reading from you 15 years ago. And it was really, really helpful. And I found your card. I thought, oh, she's probably not in business any longer. I can't believe you're at the same number. And so he came back into business. And so I see him now every year. He had lost contact with me because he moved. And so he lost the card and it just turned up. And so again, the consistency. I'm always here. I'm always going to take care of you. And people, again, they know they can trust that. They know I'm not going to flake out. They know I'm not going to screw them over. I'm going to show up when I say I show up. I'm here. So I think that's important. And I see this happen a lot. I'm going to really quickly say this in my business, but also in other businesses, where people will start out really strong, and then all of a sudden they start flaking out, not showing up. They've got excuses. They've got this problem, that problem, or they're constantly changing their brands and people don't know who the hell they are or what they're doing from 1 minute to the next. That creates a problem. It creates this issue of trust. So how to make it in business? Be someone that people can trust. Show up as who you are. Be authentically you. Don't put on a fake stuff and do what you say you're going to do, damn it.
Yeah, I actually, something that, you know, really stands out for me from what you're saying is, you know, I think it's easy just based on, you know, what you've said about, you know, 100% showing up for your clients, all that. It's easy. I think, I don't want to say to take that too far because that's not the right terminology, but, you know, where you're in this constant hustle working 24/7, like this is what it means to be consistent. But it's really refreshing for me to hear, you know, you be so passionate and committed and consistent on the heels of everything we just talked about boundaries and about self-care. Yep. And like, I think that that's what enables the consistency and not flaking out. Like the people that I know who have kind of burned out in their businesses, it is because it's, I'm 100% there all the time, you know, even up to I answer client emails at midnight or whatever, versus, like, I'm sure that's not what you do, you know, that it's almost like counterintuitive that we think as soon as we start carving out really strict boundaries and time for ourselves and prioritizing self-care, that that's going to mean we're less successful. And every instance, you know, with someone that I've talked to, it's actually been the opposite.
It's totally the opposite. Let me tell you, with that hustling thing, I will admit I am a workaholic. I do love to work. And it's just in my blood. My father was a workaholic. When my father retired, he went nuts and he drove my mother nuts. My dad had to go out and get a job at 65, which he did for about, oh God, he must have did that till he was about 80. Then he retired from that. He went nuts again. So he got a job as a school crossing guard, just something to do. It's in our blood. You will never meet a lazy person in our family. We all just kind of love to work. It's our jam. It's the thing we're into other than cooking. So, you know, I do love to work a lot, but I do have my off hours. My office is closed at 7 o'clock. Period. I only read in person or over the phone 4 days a week. Period. I also now have began a couple months ago, I shut off the email readings on the weekends so I can have a weekend like a human being. I'm not going to be answering email readings on Sunday. I'm going to be watching Game of Thrones and doing a power walk with my daughter. You know, so I have all of my schedule. My life is very regimented. It's very scheduled that way. So yes, I'm there serving you. And by God, I am there for my clients. But I also have time for the things that are important to me, which are cooking, doing classes, reading books, chilling with my family on the weekends. So I do schedule that. And that's the thing that you made a very good point. It's very easy to burn out. And you have to have those. You have to have, again, it comes down to the safe container. If you want to show up for your clients 100%, you want to make sure that you are taking good care of yourself so you can do that. You need to know who you are as an entrepreneur, a service provider, and how you work best. And then you need to show up as that.
Yeah. Something that, again, that you just touched on, or that maybe you didn't say directly, but that came up for me. I think that one of the misconceptions, not just about tarot, but about anything in the kind of metaphysical or new age, you know, whatever container you want to say. I think that one of the myths is, and maybe this is true for certain people, that it's just this kind of loose, free flowing, like it's kind of the artistic, I work when inspiration strikes me, like that type of thing, versus, you know, what you just said about having a schedule and doing, you know, that type of stuff, that's also refreshing, that like you can have, you know, what's maybe a non-traditional or misunderstood, you know, business or path that you still treat like a business, that it's not just this kind of pie in the sky, airy fairy situation.
Actually, this is one of the biggest reasons why most tarot readers don't make it in this industry and why a lot of them struggle to have sustainable businesses. You know, there's very few of us that actually do this full time and really rock it. And it's because we treat it like a darn business. You're not just coming in here any old time for it's not a tarot flop house. You know, this is an actual business. And I treat it very, very businesslike. And again, that turns off some people. Some people want a hippie experience. I always say, I'm not hippie, I'm hip hop. And if you look at the people who do hip hop, and those are my big inspirations, that's why you see pictures of Jay-Z and Rick Ross above my desk. These guys commit. They show up. They do the work. They work their asses off, but they also make their time to do the things that they enjoy doing too. But they are pros all the way. And I really aspire for that. I want to be a pro. I want to have my business treated like a serious thing. I want it respected. I don't want to be seen as like loosey-goosey or airy-fairy. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I want this to be a legit biz. And that's very important. So you got to treat it like a business. You have to, or you're not going to make it. Not in this world. Mm-mm.
Yeah. So this might be putting you on the spot a little bit, but is there anything that comes to mind as far as either tips or business advice for other, let's say, metaphysical entrepreneurs?
Well, the first thing is to treat your business like a damn business, you know, which means stop goofing around, have a schedule, pay your taxes, have an accountant, you know, really make sure that you are doing legitimate business things. The other thing too, for people in like the metaphysical industries, a lot of us are people who, you know, tend to not like the sales part of things. We hate it. We'd rather just kick back and read our cards. I get that. But you can't have a business if you're not out there trying to make the sale. Learn some good marketing techniques. Get your name out there. Let people see what you're all about. You know, show and tell. So I really highly recommend, if you're in a metaphysical industry, you want to have a very structured business. And you also want to be able to get out there and not be afraid to ask for the sale. It's okay. It doesn't mean you're selling out if you are promoting your business. You have to promote it.
Yeah. This is great. I mean, I do think that that's true. I think it's true for, you know, artists and creatives and stuff as well. Like, oh, I just want to do my thing and not focus on, you know, the sales side of it or anything like that. Which I think is what differentiates a hobby from a business, right? If you just want it to be your hobby, that's totally fine. But for you personally, have there been any specific either marketing tools or marketing strategies that have been really effective for you, or maybe some that even haven't worked so well that you've tried?
The thing that works so well for me, I love social media. And I will say, you don't need social media to make it. You really don't. I mean, Alexandra Franzen's a really perfect example. She used to be on social media, and then she went off of it. It's not her thing. And she still has a very successful business because she is good at what she does, and she takes very good care of her clients. Anyone who works with her will tell you that. She's got a killer reputation. So, you know, building your reputation is really important. And for me, the social media has been very helpful because I've been able to connect with people, show them my personality. People know what I'm all about. And I do a lot of that mostly through Twitter, which has been my favorite. That's really worked out well for me. So if I had to think about what promotional things haven't worked for me, I don't do joint ventures. That I don't do. I don't like joint ventures.
What do you mean by that?
Joint ventures are these telesummits. Do you know what those telesummits
are?
Yeah,
I get invited to that kind of stuff all the time. Yeah.
I get invited to those. I don't do those.
Me either.
Mm-hmm. They're not my thing. I know that people do that as list building gimmicks, and I don't like gimmicks. I don't like the idea, like, we're going to do this to get your list. It's just weird to me. So I don't do anything like that. I just feel uncomfortable. It feels really like I'm being pushy, and No. I find the best thing for me is just let me show people who I am through blogging, through interviews like this, through, you know, being on social media, my card of the day post. That's what gets people to know me. And they can, again, judge then, do I want to work with this lady, or is this lady, you know, she's listening to this rap music today. I don't want to work with this lady, you know. I find that it works quite well for me.
Yeah. It's funny when you mentioned like the teleseminars and that type of stuff, like there, you know, when I was first starting out doing things, you know, and I would think, oh, I have to say yes to every opportunity. And I'm sure there's kind of a school of thought that maybe supports that, you know, and I did a couple of things in that arena that never felt good. A lot of it, because it was a lot of pressure. You have to share this with your whole list, or you have to, for whatever reason, they were experiences that left me not feeling good. And that, you know, for better or worse, I'm someone who can't really fake something. Like if I'm not really in it and not really enjoying it, you can tell. And right. if that's the case, then it's not going to wind up being, you know, the beneficial marketing opportunity that someone might say that it is, because I'm not showing up in a way that would lead people to want to work with me. Right. So yep. like for me, and now it's in terms of evaluating opportunities, it's like, because I think what you said about time, you know, being a finite and really valuable resource. And I'm very aware of that too, with having a podcast that's long form, right? 2 hours is a large chunk of time to ask, you know, for from someone. And for me, when I'm evaluating, you know, let's say what shows I'm going to be a guest on or that type of thing, you know, it's easy to say, oh, well, this person, you know, has a bigger audience, so I'm going to say yes to being on that show because it might do something for me. I found that never really works out. It has to be, is this how I want to spend, you know, an hour yes. or 2 hours of my time, regardless? And if it is, then it always produces the best result anyway, you know?
Absolutely, because it's natural. That's the one thing I also want to say. I never give a rip about numbers, never. One of the things I always say is I don't care about SEO. I care about PEOPLE. That's what I care about. And so if I'm going to do a podcast, if I'm going to do any kind of thing, it's not because I'm like, oh, my God, I hope I get a lot of numbers. My thing is I hope I have an impact. I hope I help someone. So if I'm going to say yes to anything, it has to be something like, I hope I'm going to be able to help someone. I really want to bring sincerity forward. You know, if you start focusing on numbers, you're going to make yourself nuts. And unfortunately, it's easy to do that because you have a lot of these people who go and they put all these numbers out there and they're like, well, you know, if you sign up for my class, you will learn how to make six figures working 4 hours a week and blah, blah, blah. And you start hearing these numbers. Or you start hearing these big SEO numbers. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs, we get the wrong idea from that. We think, oh my God, I've got to go sign up for this thing or do this telesummit or whatnot, because those numbers. And we lose real sight with what the hell are you in business for? Are you in business to be a number? Are you in business to rack up a bunch of numbers? No, most of us go into business because we're passionate about what we do. Well, at least I hope we are, that we're passionate about what we do and we really truly want to provide a service. And if you are getting all hung up on that gross number stuff, you're going to go way off the track. You're going to get yourself nuts.
Yeah. Also, I think for me, you know, having fallen into that trap from time to time, it's like always a recipe for dissatisfaction, because then there's always a higher number or someone else who, you know, is doing quote better or whatever. That, you know, the thing for me that made me really unhappy, you know, at times in my life and business when I fell into that kind of stuff, was forgetting that everything is actually just person to person human interaction. Like if I think yes. of like, it's the kind of exercise that I like to use with myself is, you know, especially with like the sales stuff, if I kind of get caught up in that, I'm thinking, okay, what was the last purchase that I was so excited to make, right? The person who announced yes. the pre-order of their book and I could not get my credit card out fast enough. I don't mind that they're selling that to me. Like what differentiates that from the people who I'm like, I have to unsubscribe from this email, right? Like that's essentially the same thing. They're both providing a service or a product for sale, telling me it's available and how I can buy it. But looking at like, why am I excited to buy the things that I'm excited to buy? And I'm sure that's different for everyone, but a lot of it has to do for me with like feeling like a human being and this like person to person connection of stuff.
There's nothing worse than when someone treats you like a number. There's nothing worse. You know, one of the things that I really love, and this is what's going to make me loyal to someone for life, when they answer their own emails.
I was just going to say the yes. exact same thing. Yep.
My God, that makes me just fall in love with you. When I get a timely email from you personally, wow, I feel then like you really are in your business. You're not passing me off to someone. I love that so much. I just love that. You know, and Alexandra Franz, we'll go back to her as an example. When, you know, you reach out to her, you get a response back from her. You don't feel like you're being passed off to a nameless assistant. I really love that.
Yeah, I love that too. I mean, and I'm sure that there are people listening who would make an argument for, you know, having assistants or, you know, the way to grow your business and that kind of stuff. And that's, again, totally fine. But I think it goes back to what you said about knowing kind of the type of business that you want to have. That's, for me, like, I actually love email. I think a lot of people have this like very contentious relationship with email. No, it's not where I want to spend all of my time, you know, because then I'm not doing some other, you know, bigger projects and stuff. But, you know, I get emails sometimes from people, you know, either listeners of the show or, you know, people yeah. who have read my writing. And, you know, I always laugh when it starts off with like, I know you're so busy that you probably won't read this. And that actually makes me sad. And while I know that maybe it's possible to hit a tipping point, you know, I think of someone like Tim Ferriss, you know, whose podcast I love. And, you know, at the bottom of his emails, yeah. it specifically says like, please don't email. Like I cannot answer 100,000 emails a day, which so maybe you do get to a point where it becomes an unsustainable thing, right?
Yes.
Which is fine. And I respect, but for me right now, it is sustainable. And I do read the emails and I always love hearing from them. And like on the same other token, it's like someone real is reading your email. So like consider their feelings, right? Like,
yes.
So we're real people here.
Yes. And I do want to back up and say that there is going to be times where maybe you can't get to every email. And I don't always answer every email. Once in a while, when I get something that's really creepy, you can better believe that's hit and delete. but and sometimes, you know, there's some people like Tim Ferriss is a great example. They have such a wide base that there's no way in hell they can do it. That's a very different story. That's totally understandable. I don't expect that I'm going to write to Jay-Z and he's going to write me back personally. I'd love that, but I know very well that's not going to happen. But I got to say, I do love the personal touch.
Well, I think it depends on the nature of your business too,
yeah.
right? Because you used Alex Franson as an example. And it's funny. She was on season one of the show. I'm so grateful that she's, you know, a good friend. And I feel like she comes up in like 80% of the other podcast episodes. So clearly girl's doing something right, because she is always a good example from everyone for everything. But,
yeah.
You know, her business, your business, you know, stuff that I've done in the past, it's a one person to one person, or even maybe even like one to a small class, right? Or that type
yes.
of thing, where when that's your business, I think it makes sense to answer your own emails.
Absolutely. And, you know, are you familiar with Abby Kerr?
I know who she is, but I don't know her personally.
Okay, well, she has this thing, and it's at Abby Kerr, I hope I'm saying it right, KERR.com, and she's got this quiz you can take that tells you about your voice values, and it tells you how you can show up in your business. And one of the things that, when I took her quiz, I got was intimacy. And so my work is very intimate. The other thing that I found, too, I took the Strength Finders quiz. There's a book you can buy on that. And my number one thing was relator, which is relationships. So when I think about relationships and intimacy, is these are my strengths, these are my core values. And I really try to bring that through in my business. I am all about creating a relationship with my clients, taking care of them one-on-one. We're intimate. You're going to hear from me. You're not getting an assistant. You're going to hear directly from me. That does work for me. It's not going to work for everybody, though. You do have to know your business and how you want to serve your clients, and then find a way to do that and do it well.
Yeah, it's funny. I got the relator thing in the StrengthsFinder test too. So we have that in common. So a couple more things about Tara that I would love to talk about. Do you have tips for, let's say someone's listening and has never had a tarot reading before and they're really interested in it, tips on how to get the most out of their reading?
Absolutely. The first number one thing, just come with an open mind. Really come with an open mind to the experience. Whether you're doing a phone reading, an email reading, or whatnot, the more open-minded you are, first of all, the better for the reader and the better for you. If you're coming with preconceived notions or fear or any of that, you're going to find that you're not really being energetically open to the experience. I know that sounds, again, kind of strange, but be open. I think that is probably the best piece of advice. If you're going to be getting a phone reading or an in-person session, I recommend coming up with some questions that you want to ask. Because oftentimes what ends up happening is people walk out of the office and say, oh, crap, I forgot to ask about Uncle George. So I do recommend having a little bit of an idea about what you want to ask about, because most readers are going to want to, you know, maybe do a general outlook for you and then give you time to ask about things that are important to you. So know what you want to ask about. Have a little list. Make sure that you are coming in then with that so that you can, you know, get the most out of your reading. I also recommend recording your reading if you are forgetful or if you're the type of person that tends to only hear what you want to hear. Record your reading, because later on you can go back, you can refer back to it. This is why, again, email readings are so brilliant. You have the written record you can look at and say, oh, yeah, that's what that said. You know, but have a way that you can refer back to it, because sometimes you'll get a reading and you know what, Nicole, it might not make sense. And later on you listen to it, it's like, oh, that's what that meant. Got it. Mm-hmm. So those are probably the three tips. Be open-minded. Have an idea what you want to ask about. And then give it time to percolate, but have a way that you can refer back to the reading.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm curious if I know that you've said that kind of anyone can learn to read tarot or that type of thing. I'm interested to hear if you have any either tips or strategies that have worked for you or, you know, that you know have worked for others to help them develop their intuition.
Yes. Meditation is the very best tool to connect with it. And the reason why is most of us have monkey minds, myself included. We have very, very busy minds. And also a lot of us, we grow up and we're told that, you know, oh, that's all malarkey. Don't pay attention to that. You know, that's not logical. The world isn't always logical. I wish it was, but it's not. And so meditation allows us to shut out and filter out all that other BS so we can really start to feel and hear that small voice within ourselves. So I really recommend meditation as a way to connect with yourself. I also recommend, too, writing down your insights. I always tell people when you're wanting to learn tarot, you should start with a tarot journal. Do some readings, write down what you're getting, refer back to it, look back on it. It's kind of like doing your homework. You know, you do your math homework, you look back, you can see exactly how you came to that conclusion. Do that with your insights, too. Get a vibe about something, don't ignore it, pay attention, maybe write it down, reflect on it later. It's often really uncanny, those gut feelings and stuff, how well they work and how often we ignore them.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. So this is a great place to transition into the way that I love to end these conversations, which are with what we call community questions. So they're questions that the Real Talk Radio listeners have put forth and asked to hear about from each guest of a given season. So this, for season 4, we have 9 of these questions. So sort of rapid fire-y, but feel free to answer as short or as long as you want, if that sounds good.
I'm ready.
Okay, so the first question, and we've kind of talked about this a little bit, but is about self-care and self-kindness, which are buzzwords that get thrown around a lot. And I'd love for you to share what it actually looks like for you kind of in your real life, day-to-day practical terms when you're practicing self-care and kindness.
I really make that a huge, huge part of my life. I think being kind to yourself and being compassionate with yourself allows you to be so much more of that for the people that you are working with or living with or loving. So how does self-care and compassion work for me? I don't start work till 1 o'clock. So my mornings, I take my mornings slow. I do my yoga. I meditate. I have a lot of tea. I take care of these cats who are very demanding. In the morning, I go for a walk every morning with my husband and we get coffee and we spend time connecting with each other. Those things start my day off. At the end of the day, when my work day is done, it is done. And then I start cooking, and cooking is my way to nourish myself, to be creative, and to also make sure that I'm, you know, really winding down. I get a nice glass of wine. I cook a dinner. My husband and I kick back. We'll put on a favorite show or read a book. These are the things that really allow me to feel nourished and cared for. And the kindness thing, you know, I think that gets easier as you get older. Because when I was younger, I was a lot harder on myself. But now that, you know, I'm 50, I'm going to be 51 soon, I can like look back and say, oh my God, I was trying so hard back then. I was so hard on myself. And I can be really nice to myself now. I'm not going to sit and rip on myself because I no longer fit in a certain size pants. I'm not going to worry about the gray hair or the wrinkles. You know, I don't worry if I don't do everything perfectly in my job. I just always remind myself that I'm doing the best I can. And so I tend to like really try to give myself a lot of compassion, and I shut down my own critic, and I tend to also ignore the critics and the negative Nellies in the world. You know, it's just not my thing. I don't want to hear that. I don't want that vibe around me. So I would say I'm kind to myself because I know that the other way doesn't feel good. And you know what? It doesn't drive me to do better. It only drives me nuts.
I'm obsessed with everything you just said. I'm just gonna leave that right there. And so the next question, who would you say are your two or three favorite people to follow on social media?
Ooh, my two or three. Well, I love Chrissy Teigen because I think she's so damn smart and clever. And I love that cookbook. I told you I'm obsessed about it. So I really just adore the heck out of her. I think everything that she does is amazing. So Chrissy Teigen would be my favorite person to follow. And let's see, who would be my other person to follow? You know, there's a couple celebrities I like to pay attention to, too. A lot of rappers, because I do like rappers. I love Amber Rose. I just love Amber Rose. I think she's so controversial. She doesn't give a rip, and I think she's really smart, and people underestimate her. So those are probably the two people that I love. I know they're not in my industry, and I should probably be listing people in my industry, but I tend to watch things that are outside of my industry. I get very, very inspired by so many other things, but those two gals, I like watching their stuff. I like the cut of their jib.
Yeah, I mean, that's honestly why. So people submit questions, right, for these community questions, and I pick the ones that resonate with me the most each season. And the reason I love this question, and this has been around, you know, in previous seasons, is for exactly that reason. Like, who do we actually love following? And, you know, it's fun to put links to that kind of stuff in the show notes. And even if it's not in your industry or, you know, anything like that. So, all right, I love it. When you think back over your life so far, what's something that comes to mind that you feel really proud of yourself about?
Oh, my children. Absolutely. Every mom says it. It's so cliche and so awful. But my children, I'm so proud of them. I have two kids. They are doing phenomenal. They're both super educated and just great human beings. My daughter is a writer. She's the person who I wrote a book and she went over to make sure all my punctuation's correct. She's just the most phenomenal little editor. I just am so proud of her for that. And she's a very much an introvert like me, but she's done things with her life that have been so outside of her comfort zone. So I'm so proud of her. And my son is this handsome jazz musician. He's got a master's in music. He teaches kids in the inner city, and he is like a living Buddha. My son is one of these people who's such a good guy. It's kind of disgusting because I also say, oh my God, I got to kind of up my game now and be a goody-goody around this kid. He is one of those kinds of people. So he's my conscience. He's my living Buddha, and I just am so proud of my kids. I always say the mark of, you know, good parenting is you see the results. And so I'm also proud of myself for being a pretty darn good parent. It hasn't always been easy for me, but I think I did a good job.
Yeah. I mean, being proud of the fact that you raised children that it's very clear that you look up to almost now, even, you know, so I think that's great. Yeah.
They amazed the hell out of me. I mean, again, watching her get out of the comfort zone, it's like, whoa. And watching him just be such a good human being, it's like, whoa.
I love that.
It's crazy.
So what would you say is one belief that you've been holding onto either about yourself or the world that's no longer serving you that it's time to let go of?
That I have to do everything perfectly right.
I got
a hardcore perfectionist streak. And here's how bad it was back in the day. If I got a B in school, I almost had a heart attack. How crazy is that?
I mean, you and I are cut from the same cloth. So I'm like, oh yeah, that sounds totally reasonable. That's exactly, yeah.
Who is that big of a nerd that you flip out? There's an episode of The Simpsons once where Lisa Simpson, the teacher, I think, gave her an A-, and she starts aggressively pushing the paper towards the teacher and trying to force her to change it. And I was that icky little girl. So no, perfectionism, it's not all that. It's okay to, you know, biff it once in a while.
Yeah, agreed. So which two or three books would you say have had the biggest impact on you from books from any genre?
The first book that had the biggest impact on me ever was called Truth and Consequences. And it's a book, I got it on my bookshelf. I read this when I was a kid. It's by, I think, Miriam Young Burke. I can't remember the author's name right off the top of my head. It's a book about being honest but tactful. And I read that book when I was a kid. And that book had the absolute biggest impact on my life. Because learning how to be honest, honesty is very important to me. I would rather be told the brutal truth than to be lied to. That's super, super vital to my life. And this is why I love my husband, by the way. He's the most brutally honest person I know. So I know what he says is always straight up. I love that. So that book had the absolute biggest impact on my life philosophy, how I want to live. I want to be honest, but I want to be kind. That is super important. So I would say that would be the biggest. I always come back to that book all the time, and there's probably no book that has impacted me more.
I love it. I need to read that. I mean, I've never read it, but even that title, Truth and Consequences, I'm like, that's a great title. Clearly, I want to be a part of that.
It's just, you know, this simple book about this middle school girl who learns that you got to be honest, but you don't have to be an asshole about it.
Yeah.
And I just think that is such an important lesson. Let's be a little bit nicer, people. Let's be honest, but let's not be a dick.
Totally. Right. That line, well, I'm just being honest. Okay. Well, but also you've been an asshole. So
again, when you're, and here we go back to that perfectionist thing. There are some people who make it a sport on pointing out other people's flaws. And what good are you doing? What good is that doing in the world? It's not doing any good. You can be honest without being mean. So that would probably be the one book. A book I've been reading lately that I really love, that I think everyone should read, is Daring Greatly by Brené Brown. So that's like kind of like my new thing that I've been really pretty obsessive over. And it's about being vulnerable and showing up and dealing with shame and all the stuff that we're talking about here with criticism and perfectionism. I think that's a really good book that more people should be reading. Whether you are showing up in the world or just trying to be a decent parent, it's got a lot of good stuff in there. So I highly recommend that one.
Yeah, that's a book that gets recommended a lot on the show. So her work comes up a lot. What's your guilty pleasure?
Oh, God. Trash television.
Which is what for you? What is trash television to you?
I have to admit, I love some crappy reality shows once in a while.
Yeah.
And the one I've been watching recently, my husband made me swear I will never watch it again, was Married at First Sight, which has been just an incredibly painful show to watch. So I do like some trash television. The other one I like, and people who know me know this well, I love watching Maury paternity episodes. And my husband laughs. He says to me, you hate trashy things. You hate yelling and arguing. You can't stand meanness. And here you're watching this crap. And I said, I don't know what it is.
The heart wants what it wants, right?
I just got to see if he's the daddy.
That's hilarious. What's your favorite thing to give as a gift to other people?
My time. I want to spend time with you. I want to sit for a good meal. I want to eat with you. I want to find out everything that you're doing. I want to know everything that's going on in your life right now, the good, the bad, the ugly. Time. Time is the greatest gift you can give someone. Instead of giving physical gifts to my kids now, that's what they get. We're going out to eat, and you are going to tell me everything that's going on. Dish.
Right. Giving them the gift of like undivided attention. Yeah.
Yes.
I love that. So tell me either one habit that you would like to break or one habit that you'd love to build.
I'd love to get rid of my sugar and wine habit. I'm putting two together. I love candy. I love sweets. I always have had a sweet tooth. And I've really gotten it narrowed down now. I'm not doing as much as I used to. And I love a nightly glass of wine. And I'm like, oh my God, I would be so much more fit if I didn't have that piece of chocolate and that damn glass of wine. But I am a girl who's kind of a bon vivant and I like pleasure. So I don't know if I'm ever going to totally give that up.
Yes. I love it. I mean, I think this idea of like pleasure for the sake of pleasure being important is something I've been thinking about a lot more too. So.
Oh my God. Yeah. And you know what? If I have to like eat totally healthy all the time, I die a little inside when I read these people who have these super healthy diets. It's like, oh my God, let me give you one of my cookies. You will change your mind. So yeah, that's something I wish I could change, but yeah, it's probably not going to happen. And if I had to probably think about what is a habit that I'd love to develop, probably for me, it always comes back to being physical. I'm very physical. I'd like to be a little more physical though. I'd really like to, you know, up some of my stuff so that I am really being in my body. And I'm in my body a lot, but I think I could be in it a little bit more.
Yeah, I love that. So the last question, when you look ahead at the next couple of months, what do you feel most excited about?
Ooh, I have a new book coming out.
Tell me about the book. Yes, that's so exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. My book is going to be published by Sounds True, which is a publisher that I totally love and respect, and they've been wonderful. It's called The Tarot Coloring Book. And so for people who love coloring books, you're going to be in luck. But also for those of us who want to learn tarot but we're intimidated by it, this is a really experiential and fun way to learn tarot. And I've written it with totally accessible language. I made it really fun. It's hip. It's modern. It's got really simple ways to really start connecting with the deck and to start learning how to read those cards. So I'm super excited. It's coming out November 1st, 2016. And I think it's going to be just a really fun intro for the tarot curious.
That's so exciting. Is it available for pre-order or is it too early?
It's available for pre-order on Amazon right now. So if you go to Amazon.com and look up the Tarot Coloring Book by Teresa Reed, it's there. And I'm just so proud of it and excited. And I just hope this gets tarot in the hands of more people who can see it as the wonderful tool that it is. And to help people who have been intimidated by some of the scholarly stuff out there to see that, hey, it's not that hard. Let me make this digestible and fun for you. Because that's the best way to learn.
Yeah, and I'll put links. I'll put the link to the pre-order in the show notes too. So for someone who's listening and wants to try, let's say doing, you know, their first email reading with you, or just wants to see more about what you're doing, what's the best place for them to find you?
They could always find me on my website at www.thetarotlady.com. And they can also find me on Twitter. My handle is The Tarot Lady, and I'm also on Instagram and Facebook with The Tarot Lady too. So they can find me all over at those social media places. But just get to my site. I'm very friendly, so I don't bite.
I love it. And you said Twitter is your kind of favorite place to interact as far as social media goes, right?
I do love Twitter quite a bit. I know lots of people now are anti-Twitter, and I'm like, you know, there's things about it that aren't perfect, but it's really a fun way to connect, and it's actually how I stay on top of the news, because I also follow a lot of these news people. So I think Twitter's pretty cool, guys.
Yeah, I love it. My husband works for Twitter, so I feel the same way. But awesome. So thank you so much. This was so delightful, and I'm really grateful that you came on the show.
Thank you, Nicole. This was an absolute delight.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening and for being such an awesome part of the Real Talk Radio community. And don't forget to go to pickybars.com and use the code REALFOOD to get $10 off the delicious 14-bar mixed pack. Yummy energy bars filled with dates, nuts, seeds, cocoa powder, and other real foods that you know and love without any of the gut wreckers like gluten, dairy, soy, and GMOs. I have no doubt that you will love these bars as much as I do. So until next time, here's a big virtual hug and a reminder that we're all just doing the best we can, and that no matter what, we're in this together.